We're going to begin the segment with our friends from the Chicago Food Encyclopedia. Editor Colleen Taylor Sen, and we've got a contributor, Michael Gebert. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having us.
And joining us in a little bit will be fellow editor Bruce Craig. And the other third editor we should mention is Carol Mighton Haddix. The three of you put this book together. So tell us what the Chicago Food Encyclopedia is and what was the motivation for it.
Well, it's really a comprehensive overview of everything to do with Chicago food. And it's not like restaurants, it's not just chefs, it's major industries, it's the history of Chicago food, why Chicago became a food center, it's technology. I mean, Chicago was like the Silicon Valley of food technology at one point. So it's just a very great overview of the city. And the motivation is kind of interesting. Bruce and I had worked on an encyclopedia of street food.
Yeah, you worked together with him. Yeah.
Yeah, so it went pretty well. So we were thinking of doing something on Chicago. A friend of ours, Andy Smith, who's one of the major food writers of the country, had just published the New York Food Encyclopedia. So we thought, hey, if there's a New York Food Encyclopedia, there certainly should be a Chicago Food Encyclopedia. So that's what we decided to work on. Bruce happened to be stopping by University of Illinois Press, talking to the editor. He just mentioned it to him, and the editor says, we have to do that. We want to do it. And then later we brought in Carol Haddix, who, of course, was the prize, you know, the winning of the editor of the Chicago Tribune food section for years. And so the three of us really had a very good collaboration.
You know, this is a good question for Michael, because you do stuff online, too. Just the idea, the book is beautiful. It really, is a great book. I want to get into some of the specifics. But just what's the idea to publish an encyclopedia today? You know, people are going online and looking up stuff like Italian food and things like that.
Well, I believe in leaving these sorts of things in parts of your house where you'll have time to sort of leaf through them. Uh-huh. And, you know, it's just it's a perfect kind of book where you have so many sides of this subject. You know, you can just open it randomly. I'm opening it here. Yeah. Cyrus McCormick, followed by McDonald's.
Yeah, you know? Right.
How could you not read that?
Yeah. It really is. You know, I want to give the listeners a flavor of you know, yeah, you can Crate and Barrel, Lithuanians, Lou Mitchell's. You just thumb through it. You know, how'd you assign the contributors? How did it come together?
Well, you know, doing an encyclopedia is a very specific kind of task. I mean, Bruce and I had contributed to dozens of encyclopedias over the years, so we had kind of a sense of how it's done. The first thing you do is you create a list of headwords, it's called. So then you have to find contributors for people
who can... So tell us what a headword is.
A headword is an entry, basically. Okay. It's the title of an entry. So Lithuanians or Cyrus McCormick. And then you have to find people to write them. In the process, those people will say, well, what about so-and-so? You know, have you covered this? So you kind of go back and forth until finally, I think we had about 200 entries, and at some point we had to say, stop, we can't keep doing this.
Yeah, how did you come to that decision? When did you decide to put the brakes on?
I think we had a word limit, actually.
You
so
did.
Yes, yeah. So once we reached the word limit, we more or less decided to stop.
Two sections. The first part's the general history. Maybe we can talk about both these sections. The first part is general history of Chicago food. Second part is the 375 entries in alphabetical order. So talk about how it's broken down.
Well, I mean, as you said, there's the introduction, which is about 18 pages, and the three of us wrote that. Then we have the entries, some of them are very short, some are very long. At the end of it, we have wonderful photographs. I mean, historic photos you've never seen anywhere else. They're both color and they're black and white. We have recipes, and these are recipes for historic Chicago dishes like shrimp de jong and Birkhoff's spinach and Carol Haddix was responsible for those. And then at the end, we have comparative prices. We have a list of resources where people can go and research their own culinary history.
Tell me about the recipe for Cohasset Punch.
Oh, no.
Is that yours? Is that yours?
Yes, it is.
Yeah, yeah.
It is.
And I mean, I've had a few cocktails in my time, but that's the definitive Chicago cocktail.
Well, listen, this is a very good point. This is the one thing that Chicago does not have. It does not have its own. The New York Encyclopedia had entry after entry on cocktails. They're the only one, and I gave a talk on this, and somebody said, what about the Mickey Finn?
Yeah.
Which, of course, is knockout drops. Cohasset Punch is so sort of, but I don't think most people know what it is.
Well, what it tell us what it is?
Gee, I think I've forgotten what it is.
It has half a canned peach in it. I know that.
Yeah, I've missed that.
And, you know, people have tried making it recently. I think there probably wasn't a place where you could actually pay for one.
Yeah,
for
was
like
there ever a place
years.
Where they were served? Or,
but I know, like, Charles Joly, who was at the Drawing Room and later at the Aviary, tried making one, and he felt he had to modernize it, that it was just kind of insipid as a drink. But, you know, it's just kind of like sweet and a kind of saccharine canned peach and things like that. But, yeah, that's a good question. What else is in it? There's the recipe.
Here it is.
Okay.
Rum. Dark rum.
Yeah, give it to us here.
Yeah. Okay, 2 jiggers each of dark rum, sweet vermouth, and orange brandy.
Oh.
And lemon.
Colleen, did you sample these?
Not the
recipe test.
No.
And it's also odd that the definitive Chicago cocktail is named for a place in Massachusetts.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't get that. But, you know, they're in Saul Bellow books. There's a there's a party that had too many Cohasset punches in one of his books.
Yeah.
So.
It was the 1950s era. Would you say? I think I read that in there.
Somewhere
in the 1950s. Yeah. You know, you mentioned, that was one of my questions. New York did a similar encyclopedia. Other cities, do you hope this gives birth to other cities doing similar encyclopedias?
Well, I don't know. I mean, it takes a unique combination of people and circumstances. I mean, Andy Smith, you know, he had done a lot of encyclopedias, and we kind of modeled a little bit after his. I don't know if... I don't know if people could do it, really. I mean, it takes, like, Bruce is an academic. I'm kind of a semi-academic. Carol was a journalist. So it took a lot of different skills.
I also think it's just, is the city rich enough for it? I mean, Chicago really has such a place in industry with all the companies that come from here, the crafts and things like that. It's culturally, it's such a fantastic mix, you know, of the Greek, Thai, Mexican, Vietnamese, German, whatever you want kind of cuisine. You know, it is an endlessly rich city for food, and food reveals a lot about the city when you investigate it. So, I mean, it might be a thinner pamphlet for certain places.
You know, I'm born and raised here, and there seems to be such a proud cultural memory. I mean, you know, people just are really, really proud of Chicago. I'm not saying that's not true in other cities, but there's a real ownership to stuff here. Do you find that in the places you go to? And
absolutely.
It's a signal, you know what I mean?
I think that's absolutely true. And, you know, one of the things that really struck me is, you know, John Drury's famous book, 1931, Dining in Chicago. He said, Chicagoans don't need to travel. They can travel the world in Chicago. So this business of ethnic restaurants, it's not anything new. You had Filipino, you had Russian, you had Japanese in 1930. So it's always been a multi-ethnic food city.
Where can people, I want to get into some of the history when Bruce joins us, but where can people find the book? How's it been going?
Oh, it's been doing pretty well. You can get it from the publisher. You can get it from Amazon. Bookstores have it.
It's been doing real well.
Yeah.
Michael, how'd you get involved?
Bruce just contacted me and asked me what I wanted to write about. And I contributed the section on advertising, which I've worked in. And then I also noticed I'm used as a source in a few places, which I found that, you know, I was more honored by that.
And you were a contributor too, Dave.
Yes,
I am. You wrote several entries.
Yeah,
also.
I did. What did I do? I did supper clubs or something. Yeah, I haven't written down, but yeah, it was fun. Really, I'm proud to be part of it.
Thank you.
Advertising, that's not on my list of questions. So here's a big advertising center. How did that influence the food industry?
Well, it really drove a lot of things. In the early days before, you know, up to around World War I, it was mostly outdoor advertising. And if you, any picture you see of an old ballpark, it's going to have a Cracker Jack ad or a Wrigley or somebody like that in the background. After that, radio. I mean, right here, we're in WGN where, Cheerios sponsored the Lone Ranger and things like that. You know, soap operas were invented here. That's not food, but it's that kind of packaged goods is always a distinct part of the industry that includes a lot of food things. Then you get into the 50s, 60s, 70s, you know, Leo Burnett, where, which is one of the places I worked, you know, it was very much about the inherent drama, as Leo said, which is to say that you found something that personified your brand. You know, that was Charlie the Tuna, who wanted to become Starkist, and the Green Giant, who, you know, that was so successful they changed the name of the company to Green Giant.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, all those kind of characters. And I tell the story that was kind of famous lore around Burnett that you know, at some point in a meeting, you know, they took the critters so seriously. At some point in a meeting, someone yelled at someone, "Oh, Snap would never say that to Pop."
Okay, we're going to take a break. Bruce Craig is on the phone, so he's going to join us after the break, and we're going to talk more of the great Chicago Food Encyclopedia, and it is out on University of Illinois Press, available right now. So don't go away on the download for Justin Coffin.
Try the salami, Tommy. Give it to gravy, Davy. Everybody eats when they come to my house. Try a tomato.
Welcome back to the download with Justin Coffman, but I'm Dave Hoekstra. How's that, Dan? That's good. Okay. And we're here with our guests. We have Colleen Taylor Senn, editor of the one of the editors of the Chicago Food Encyclopedia, contributor Michael Gebert, and on the phone, baseball fan Bruce Craig, an editor for the Chicago Food Encyclopedia. Thanks for joining us, Bruce.
Hi, thanks for having us.
And we've been talking a little bit. I want to get a little bit into the roots of all this and the deep history of I read in the foreword, and we were talking about this during the break, about how Chicago is a crossroads of America, is vulnerable to this approach as a crossroads type thing. Can you talk about an alternate way to look at the food history of Chicago?
Well, you mean as an intake of food and then a processor and exporter of food? Yeah.
Yeah, industrial food products. And yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's like think of it as a pump, right? You put raw materials in, and it pumps finished blood material, good finished materials out, and that's the reason Chicago exists. That's why it was set up in the first place.
Uh huh. Uh huh. You guys want to elaborate on that? Yeah, just the history?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's the food production here has been such a big thing. The Crafts and those kind of companies, and then later on McDonald's and companies like that. I mean, we really are a center of industrial food, and the kind of artisanal food movement that's come along in recent years particularly is kind of just a bit of a gloss on the enormity of the whole food production system, which also has a lot of cultures that go into it as well. I mean, I was just reading the entry on La Preferida, which is a Chicago-based brand of Mexican food products that you've probably seen in stores around here. There's lots of, you know, Greek, Middle Eastern. There's a chickpea company in Cicero, which is a pun for all you classicists out there,
yeah.
And things like that. And it's just, that's been the diversity of Chicago, has been all this, you know, this way that we've made food something that was easy to stick on a truck or in a train.
Well, one thing that I mentioned earlier, like Chicago being the Silicon Valley of food processing equipment, because so many, for example, the Mixmaster was invented here, and household appliances, but also large scale things. For example, you were mentioned.
Oh, the Folds Oven.
The Folds Oven. Which
this is like the great Chicago pizza oven. And I didn't write this entry, but I'm a source at the end of it, which I'm very proud of. But yeah, it's basically a rotary oven, which means there's kind of like a Ferris wheel inside the oven, and your pizza goes around and around on it. And that was invented and refined here. Originally, it's more of a bakery oven, but it is really the Chicago pizza oven, and the places that have them love them dearly and take good care of them.
Now you did remind me of one of my proudest contributions is Popeil.
Yes.
Yeah, Popeil thing being out of Chicago. Yeah, that's so much fun, the Ron Popeil stuff. What was it, Bruce and everybody here, what was the research, what was the research procedure like? You know, as a journalist, I like digging around. We've mentioned Peter Engler during the break. I just love looking at old menus. I've done my supper club books. Now I've got a big collection of vintage supper club menus. What was the research procedure like for this and the other projects you guys work on?
Well, you want me to say?
Yeah, go ahead, Bruce.
Let me go back and say one more thing. The locavore movement that's going on now, which is okaram among chefs, is really old. One thing we discovered in doing the book was that Chicago, what you think of as the city, was once farm. Chicago was literally orbs in horto, and city in a garden. And, for example, Lakeview was one of the major celery-producing areas of America before it became Lakeview. I know it's hard to believe.
It is hard to believe.
And there are farms all over the place that supplied the city. So when you went to a restaurant in the 19th century, you were eating local food. I mean, literally local food grown in Chicago. And so, you know, everything sort of comes back, right? It revolves back again to its origins, and that's what's happened here, I think.
That's interesting. Bruce, I loved your squash pie recipe. Bruce, tell us about the squash pie.
I didn't write it. It's Carol Haddock, sir.
But, I mean, it was one of the earliest recipes out there, right?
It is. It is the earliest recipe that we've been able to find in Chicago. One thing we did in this book that others don't is we looked at cookery books published in Chicago. Not community cookbooks, because that's an overwhelming job, but actual published books and recipes. So we have a whole section on this, and I think it's one of my favorite sections.
One of my favorite entries is the one we did on food and literature I think that was just excellent. I mean, the person who, I don't remember who did it, but all the references to food, and not just things like the stockyards and, you know, the obvious things, but like Edna Ferber and Saul Bellow, and it was just such an interesting entry.
It is. So you reading that and doing that, you realize just how central food has been to Chicago's identity. And so anyway, squash pie is one of the first recipes we've been able to find. There's just not a lot of vernacular recipes, you know, from people's home cooking. There's just not a lot of that, but that's one of the early ones we found. The earliest one dates to the 1850s, and it's called the Cake Baker.
Hmm.
So, yeah. So, and it came from a bakery in New York. Some guy was enamored of it and did a book on it. And that's the earliest one published in Chicago. So, you know.
Okay, we're going to take a break for the news. You guys are going to hang around a little bit later for the news. We'll go to, and we're going to go back after the news to talk more on the Chicago Food Encyclopedia. So don't go away on WGN. Welcome back to The Download with Dave Hoekstra, sitting in for Justin Kaufman. And we're talking about the Chicago Food Encyclopedia. And we have editor Colleen Taylor Sen in the studio, editor Bruce Craig on the phone, and contributor Michael Gebert here in the studio. Thank you all for coming in. Bruce, we were talking during the break. I kind of wanted to go in this direction. We were talking about neighborhoods. And I know Colleen's from Toronto, and I live right on the border of Ukrainian Village and Humboldt Park, and I know when I walk like two blocks, I've left Ukrainian Village, I've gone into Humboldt Park. My experience in Toronto is things kind of fall into each other more in neighborhoods. Can you talk about how neighborhoods in Chicago influenced this book?
Yeah, Colleen and I discussed this at some length, not only for this one, but for another book we did on street food. Because the similar things apply. Chicago has always been a city of neighborhoods from the very start, and that's because of migration. So we have different ethnic groups in settling in. And you know the way this happens. Somebody comes or a family comes, and then they settle in, bring their relatives. In the case of the Catholic communities, the church is set up, the parish is set up, and that becomes the focus of that community. And so with the Irish and Ukrainians, well, Ukrainians Orthodox, and any number of other minority groups, they tend to keep discrete boundaries. Somebody years ago did a study of Chicago gangs, and they discovered that the boundaries of the city between gangs in the 19th century and early 20th century retained their shape, even though the ethnicity had changed.
Wow.
And this would be things like streets and bridges, the river, and other things, which is really interesting. And the one thing that Colleen and I always say to each other is, we decided not to do neighborhoods in this book because they keep changing. And they have changed in the time I've been in Chicago, which is 40 years. I'm from New York originally. They have changed dramatically, and this is still going on.
Well, and I think one of the things about food is that it's the first point of contact between all those groups, and that's what's so fascinating about it. I mean, it is your opportunity to get into, you know, the Ukrainian culture a little bit, for the price of dinner at a Ukrainian restaurant or any other culture. And I see you have a new Ukrainian restaurant, actually, in Ukrainian Village that just opened. It's probably the first time that's happened in some years.
Yeah, right.
But yeah, it's always the entry point. It's where you get a little bit of the idea. And, you know, I mean, there are plenty of these, many cultures. I've never known anybody socially or at work who comes from those cultures. And yet I've got a lot of familiarity from them from going into the restaurants.
Well, the prime example is Devon Avenue, where we live near Devon Avenue. And of course, it was really Jewish until the 1950s. And then South Indians started coming in, then more Pakistanis. And now it's becoming, the Jewish community is kind of reclaiming it because of the growth of the Orthodox community. So it's fascinating. And all the time we've been here, like 40 years, to see the change and the constant to, you know, in, the restaurants are always changing too. Yeah, yeah. So it's fascinating.
Well, there is one dish which reflects this ethnic mixing of East European and Mediterranean and German Central European. You know what that is?
Mm. No.
The hot dog.
Hot dog.
Oh, okay.
That's always the answer to his questions.
That's my answer for everything, right?
You know what you've got going for you in this book is, in my career at the Sun-Times and in the food books I have written, is just, and if you can talk about this, is just all you guys in writing and literature, is just the power of food memory. You know, I've gotten some of my best interviews just sitting with somebody at a dinner table or at a diner and stuff. Can you just talk about how food makes the memory work?
sure.
Well, maybe it only works for me.
Yeah. No, you're absolutely right. And, you know, it's the kind of thing that people have, you know, great, you know, ties.
It brings stuff out of people.
The things
really
they grew up with. I mean, yeah. You know, you certainly get, you know, the most enthusiasm out of people for things they probably don't even eat that much anymore, like Italian beef, say. I mean, I think a lot of people have sort of made that a very occasional thing, and yet they have very firm opinions on Italian beef anytime you bring it up, or pizza or anything else like that.
Tonight at dinner we had this pecan tart, and I said to my husband, oh, this is like a butter tart. And of course, butter tart is not a fancy thing. And he said, what? But to me, a butter tart has all kinds of resonance of my childhood and things. So that's,
I mean, I've got the book in front of me. Here you go. Lou Mitchell's Restaurant. There's a memory there. Keebler Company, of course. Jim Shoe, you know. Ganella. I used to live right over by there, too, before they moved to the suburbs. Ganella Baking Company. It's just the way it just stirs things up, you know. Can you talk about that, Bruce?
Yeah. There's one. Well, there's a huge literature on this in scholarship and in popular writing also about and in the scientific literature. By the way, you know that the food technology is centered here in Chicago. So we're at the forefront of taste and technology. But anyway, there's a lot of people have talked about this and what it is that stirs your memories and everything else. And I have one for Chicago. Every Chicagoan knows this. It's when you walk out toward north of the river and you get sort of toward Halsted Street, there's a smell, an odor, which permeates Chicago. Everybody knows what it is. You know what it is?
Yeah.
Blummer's chocolate.
Chocolate.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
And that's a serious Chicago thing. When I think about going in Chicago, I smell Blummer's chocolate.
Mm-hmm.
And every time I smell chocolate, I think of the city and where that place is.
Well, you know, walking over here tonight from the L, walk through the crowds outside Pizzeria Uno. And I mean, there's an example of somebody that's been around for 80 years now. You know, it's not like you can't get pizza anywhere else in this city. And yet there's people lined up on a Friday night because it's a family memory. Yeah. It's what you do.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah.
Aren't they mostly tourists, though, that go to Pizzeria Uno?
Even so.
Yeah.
I think
yeah.
a lot of tourists are people from the suburbs and things like
that.
So it is it's a city memory.
Yeah. Michael, in the little time we have left, talk about what you do and how that brought you into this project.
Well, I have a site called Fooditor that is my own online magazine, although some other people write for it as well. And, you know, not to horn in on this book, which is a magnum opus, but I have a small book of my own called The Fooditor 99 that is kind of a rival to the Michelin Awards that came out today.
Yeah, talk about that. We have breaking news, right?
Yeah. Michelin, you know, Michelin, talking about tourists, I mean, Michelin is very much oriented to tourists. It's for people. You know, the other thing about Michelin, I think, really is it's for people who want a guaranteed thing. They want something that is their one chance to eat in Chicago, and they want the thing that they know is going to be good. And that's just not how Chicagoans live. We check out places in our neighborhood. We give them a try. We give them another try 6 months later, that kind of thing. And so mine is kind of more skewed toward that. You know, what is a Chicagoan want to check out that's new and interesting in the city? And in general, I mean, that's what I think I like to write about, and I'm sure I'm similar to a lot of the people who contributed to the food encyclopedia, and that it's, you know, every food has a story, every food has people behind it, and telling that story reveals something about the city. You know a little bit more about a place in it, about a part of it that you didn't know before.
And what were the Michelin ones? What was announced today?
I've
never been to any of them.
Yeah, it's very few, actually. A restaurant called Smith, that's a year old, went up to 2 stars from 1. New 1 stars in places called Elska and Entente. And the most interesting thing to me is I thought they might knock the restaurant in the Trump Tower down because it had a new chef. But it actually held on to its 2 stars. Despite protesters out front and whatever else may be going on there. So.
Yeah. Are you guys worried about, what's your take on like just old school places? You know, life changes, things move on. I mean, I'm just thinking as we're talking here, Gold Knox is gone. I still like going to La Scarola. That's kind of old now. What's your take on, with all these newer restaurants and Chicago being such a destination for this, how do the older restaurants hang on?
That's a very good question. You know, some of them, they have their neighborhood fan base, and they last forever. You know, Tufano's in Vernon Park, which basically doesn't exist except for being Tufano's.
Right.
It's a place that's still packing them in every night of the week. And I think there's a lot of love for that kind of places. It's also true that those places get tired sometimes, and you know, the population just isn't there anymore. I mean, we don't have German food anymore because there aren't Germans emigrating anywhere. Germany's richer than we are, so they don't emigrate here like they did in the 50s and 60s. So.
Yeah, I found that we're going to talk about that later in the show with our blues guys, but I certainly found that and Bruce, you guys know this, and the soul food. I mean, the neighborhoods changed with the soul food restaurants, and people died. Go ahead, Bruce.
They're disappearing.
Yeah.
And another thing we discovered while doing this book, and it's shameful. It's a shame in many ways, but understandable in other ways. There are food fashions, and German food, for example, has fallen out of fashion. People think it's heavy and they're bland, and it isn't. But the same with soul food. People have thought of it as not healthful, and the neighborhoods have changed. And a lot of the chefs who would be making what we think of as soul food have gone on. They've been trained in culinary schools, and they've been, you know, mainstreamed into other things. So there's a decline in that as well.
And then you get into semantics, and we got to wrap it up. But is Big Jones? I mean, is that soul food or is that Southern? You know, I don't know.
Yeah, it's Southern.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a very good restaurant.
Yeah, it is.
Really.
Yeah. Well, thank you, guys. This is good.
Thank you. This really clicked along, isn't it?
Yeah,
this
is fun. So it's the Chicago. Give me all the details again, how people can. It's really, really wonderful. It's a great, great book. The Chicago Food Encyclopedia.
Get it from bookstores. You can buy it on Amazon. You can get it from University of Illinois Press. And,
It's everywhere. Can I say one last thing?
Yeah, go ahead, Bruce.
My condolences to Cubs fans from a White Sox fan.
Okay, Bruce. I was there all night last night, right to the very end. So thanks, Bruce. Thanks, okay. Colleen. And thanks, Michael.
Thank you.
Don't forget the Chicago Food Encyclopedia.